Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting, fun-filled episode of the Michael and Patty Show, coming to you live from the Down East Mall and also the world headquarters of the Eastern Powerhouse Patty Real Estate Office, recently opened. Hello, Patty.
Hi, Michael.
Today, we're going to discuss condos and not getting into trouble with them. It's my understanding that the Canadian government has mandated that studies actually be done on the reserve funds for condos. So we're going to talk about that and some other stuff. But if you're not aware, when you buy a condo, essentially you're kind of buying into a small business, in essence, aren't you, Patty?
Yes, it is. It's a whole community.
So you're buying into a building and essentially you're going to own your unit. And physically, condos aren't necessarily apartment buildings or row houses. They could be anything. A condo could be a single house, and maybe there's two or three houses that are part of this condo corporation. But essentially, what you're doing is you're going to be sharing your common expenses and maintenance. For instance, grass cutting, snow removal, maybe the roof needs to be fixed, the siding needs to be repaired, windows are leaky. And in essence, these expenses will be shared within the members of the condo association. Who runs the condo association, Patty?
The board of directors.
And what level of training, prudential, years of experience, and formal university education do these people need to become members of this condo director, board of directors?
I'm not aware if there's any education level actually needed.
So that's one of the problems. A lot of the times with these condos, particularly the more entry-level priced ones, is you will have members on the board of directors that have no experience at all in running a board of directors. So they are charged with making decisions that we will get into momentarily here that they may not have the qualifications to decide on. Does that make sense?
Yes. And who makes up the board of directors for the condo?
People that are in the condo.
The residents within it, absolutely.
The other challenge you have is you have people like Patty and I and developers selling condos. And what's the one thing that these people are looking at when they're buying a condo? They're looking at the condo fees, right?
Well, they're looking at the floor plan and they look at the condo fees as part of their financing.
So they're buying into this condo. The condo has condo fees. The condo fees are responsible for what?
They're responsible for
what we mentioned, right?
The
maintenance, ongoing maintenance. There could be renovations. In one case in Charlottetown, the siding all fell off, and that was a $13,000 bill for each and every member. Within this condo corporation, they have what's referred to as a reserve fund. So the reserve fund will cover these problems as they arise. The challenge being is, even though the government has mandated, from my understanding, a necessity to review these reserve funds, they haven't enforced them. You've got people selling condos. They want the condo fee to be low, but it may or may not be realistic with the expectations of the building, especially if the building's starting to age. Because what you need on a 2-year-old condo building and a 20-year-old condo building are two different things.
So just to clarify, condo fees typically cover, yes, the maintenance, the upkeep of the condominium. It can also include grass cutting, common area electricity,
cleaning,
snow removal. Yes, the cleaning of the hallways and that. It is important to look into what does the condo fees cover. But at the end of the day, the most important part of the reserve fund or the condo fees that you're contributing to the reserve fund for is the upkeep and the maintenance of the building itself, which are the things that you had mentioned, Michael.
So what you're trying to do is you're trying to make sure that there's enough money contributed, typically on a monthly basis, to condo fees, which include the common area maintenance and the reserve fund. So there's not any mind-blowing expenses. For instance, this building in Charlottetown where all the siding fell off and everyone got a $13,000 bill.
Yes. Yeah, so, Michael, who should determine what the minimum reserve fee is? Because I'm sure our listeners are just thinking that the board of directors within the condo corp are just throwing numbers out there. But there's actually studies that need to take place when someone is establishing a condo. So who determines and sets the numbers?
Well, this is your point of contention or confusion, that the government really hasn't put in any laws that say we need a certain percentage of X that's going to go to this. And then when the building's getting older, we need to increase that. Like, there are no real known calculations. Engineers would certainly be helpful because they would be able to tell you what is going to fail when and what the costs are going to be. But that's where you run into problems, and that, you know, it's sort of a catch-22 situation. If you're acting in the board of directors, which you may in fact have a fiduciary legal responsibility and could in essence get sued, you're making decisions to keep the, if you're making a decision to keep the condo fees low, everyone's all great and happy until something goes wrong. If you raise the condo fees, nobody likes you and removes you from the board of directors and replaces you with somebody that tells them what they want to hear. So it's sort of a difficult position to be in, especially when you don't have any real calculations or mathematical guidance as to what those percentiles should be to calculate what the condo fee should be for the building it's involved with, or buildings it's involved with.
Yeah, and it's important that to understand board of directors may meet this year, go over the financials, determine what the condo fees, you know, depending on the age of the building, we're not going to be increasing anything. That one maybe really strong board member that controlled the meeting or dominated it and really pushed through no condo fee increase, only to find out 2 years later it was because they already knew they were going to be moving out of the condo and everyone else is impacted and affected 10 years from now. So it needs the best interest of the condo and the residents within it always need to be upheld. And hopefully they do have condo, like the reserve fund studies in place to set and determine what those condo fees should be to ensure the maintenance and the integrity of the building, therefore your investment into your condo.
The other thing is there could be two other major entities that play into this, one of which is the insurance company, not only for the individual units, but also for the entire building or buildings, and the mortgage companies. So they're going to get smarter and wiser if they haven't already. PEI typically lags behind the rest of the country as far as legislation is concerned with real estate, but they will catch on because insurance typically is federalized, as are mortgages. And they're eventually going to figure out that we don't want to be on the hook for a liability because the reserve fund's non-existent and there's a lot of outstanding deferred maintenance that hasn't happened because the board of directors hasn't taken care of the buildings.
Yeah, so as a realtor, our responsibility is to advise our buyers, is this a good purchase for you going forward? Or perhaps should we be looking at a different condo if a condo is what you're looking to purchase? And today with the pricing in Canada in general for real estate, you're finding a lot of more first-time home buyers are using a condo as their first purchase just to get into the market and to start building equity.
And it would probably be a very good idea to make sure you have all the documents pertaining to the condo corporation. And that would be the bylaws, the estoppel agreements. Have your lawyer look at those agreements. And it probably wouldn't hurt to talk to some of the board of directors members to see how they feel about the ongoing running of the condo corp. Because I don't know about you, but I find any time you put a board of directors together like this, whether it's an HOA or a condo corp, there's usually some drama involved.
My understanding is, as a purchaser, you are allowed to sit in on these meetings. So it might be in your best interest to look into when is the next meeting and can I sit in so that you can see what is the health of the condo that you are considering buying into.
Anything else we need to cover here?
No, I think we've covered condos pretty good.
On to the next subject. And this is always a point of contention between Patty and I when an offer, particularly a lowball offer, comes in, is do we counteroffer as a homeowner, a vendor, or a listing agent working with those parties? So an offer comes in, it's a silly offer, it's 30% below ask. Patty, what would you do? And every situation is different, of course, depending on who you're dealing with and who the vendors are and what the market's like and everything else.
And what else the offer contains and consists of. If everything within that offer is acceptable to my seller and the only point of contention is the price, then it may be in my seller's best interest that we counter and maybe counter, well, I would prefer to counter close or tight to the list price to let the buyer know, hey, I'd like to play with you here in a negotiation. However, you need to become a little bit more serious about the property. If not, we're not going to be going any further. That's my message.
But you've just negotiated with yourself, whereas I would just reject the offer and have them negotiate with themselves. That makes sense.
No, I understand that, and you're right. This is where we somewhat differ in our professional opinion. I feel, having represented hundreds and hundreds of buyers, that when you get a seller who just rejects it, they feel like this seller is not negotiable, therefore they're not interested in going any further. But when they see, even if it's $500 that has been negotiated or countered back, they feel like, okay, there might still be a conversation to be had here.
What if I counter offer with $1 less?
And that's an option. It lets the buyer, the message being sent, if I was representing the buyer, is this person's pretty tight to list price. We need to come up a little bit higher, or, you know, give your best offer. I know so many people watch all these shows that are out on HGTV and they want to play negotiator. They got a family member who's controlling the negotiations behind the scenes.
It's always Uncle Bob. It's always Uncle Bob.
And unfortunately, it ends up costing you money. You don't want to insult Canadians. We take our properties, many Canadians take their properties. It's very emotional. It's a personal thing. So when someone comes in with a lowball offer, it can be received as you're criticizing their home. So I do let my buyers know, put in your best offer. If you feel like you can put your head down on your pillow tonight and have a restful sleep and not stress over, you should have came in a little higher, that's the number I want. And then you just walk away. So that's my opinion on counters. Again, there are so much more to a contract than just the price.
Big news with RVs. We've had a lot of people over the years come up to us and say, I'm looking to plot my RV on a property and I'm just going to leave it there until I die. And of course, we've already discussed looking for restrictive and protective covenants. Having said that, these people have found a piece of land that have no restrictive or protective covenants indicating what they can and cannot build or do there. So they've decided to move their RV there permanently. We've had some big changes, Patty, and what have they been?
You have to have a permit in order to have an RV parked there for, I believe it's more than 30 days, isn't it?
I don't know the exact rules, but my understanding is when you're parking an RV, and we're talking about these trailers that can be pulled with a truck or a car, I believe they now want you to apply for a building permit because now you have a permanent structure there and you typically have electrical services and a septic system on that land as well. So keep that in mind. Have you seen it being enforced around the island? Because like many rules, there's all kinds of rules and laws, but they're never enforced.
I believe they are starting to enforce it. I have had a couple people within my office have conversations saying that they are aware that the province is starting. Obviously, we're probably understaffed. However, if you are a neighbor to a property, and this is probably where they're starting, and you report it, those are probably going to be the first ones that get investigated.
Okay, moving on. If you had a client indicate that they wanted to buy a house somewhere on the island, of course, the differentiating characteristics might be one's in the country, one's in the city, and they want to open up an art gallery, what would you tell them as far as the permissibility of that?
Is there covenants, restrictive covenants for this particular property?
I don't know. I haven't been talking to them. I told them to call you directly.
I would be first looking to see if there are any covenants for wherever this property is on Prince Edward Island. Are they even able to run a home business out of it, and or speak to a lawyer and see if a lawyer says this particular area? But usually we should be able to let them know if there is any covenants or what the zoning is.
We can point them in the direction to the government entity that can let them know. You don't want to let them know as a real estate agent because now you're assuming liability, and we're not in the business to interpret the law, whatever it may be today, because it may have changed yesterday in the form of an amendment or an alteration. We can point them in the direction that can find out. We could give them generalized answers, like obviously most subdivisions outside the city will have restrictive and protective covenants that will preclude commercial activity, which an art gallery is deemed to be. In the city, it would play probably more into zoning, one would think.
Correct.
But we can point you in the direction to find that out, but certain things are obvious right from the beginning. If there is something that prohibits that, we can share that with you, and then you're welcome to share it with the lawyer.
Yes, it is up to, the realtor can only provide so much information, and then it's up to the buyer to do their due diligence as well.
And we also have to make sure that the information we're giving to them is 100% correct, because there has been some limited cases in the past where agents have gone out of their way, in one instance, to obtain a building permit for a client figure, and they're just the greatest agent in the world, and they're helping them out, and then they buy the property, they go to build whatever they're building, and then the government says, oh, that approval that I gave your agent that he gave to you? Well, it's invalid, and we changed her mind because Sally isn't working here anymore, and she was fired, and she shouldn't have approved it, so sorry about your luck.
And that actually happens here on PEI.
Well, it happens across the country because that was actually taken from a court case somewhere else.
And the
bottom line was, do not do that. We're not in the building permit business. We can help them get to that point, but the ultimate authority will be the people stamping that permit. Hopefully they're not doing it in an erroneous, misinformed manner, right?
Yes.
Going to the bank first. This happens all the time. You'll have somebody go on to a banking site in Canada, BMO, RBC, TD, Scotia, whatever. They type in their information on a form and the banking website says, hey, you're pre-approved for a mortgage. This is not a pre-approval. This is sort of a preliminary, your numbers sort of work. Ultimately, you really need to get to your lending party to get approval from them before you start looking for a property, because you're going to be spending a lot of time with an agent potentially looking and a lot of time writing offers and owners receiving offers and going back and forth. And there's nothing more disappointing than to find out the purchaser has no financing.
Yeah, and we covered on our previous episode, just with regards to sellers and that, and the time they spend, only to find out when they ask for the feedback, sorry, we were working with an unqualified buyer. It doesn't instill confidence for sellers or customers, the consumer out there, to work with a realtor if we are not properly advising them right on the onset.
The real estate agents should qualify and vet their purchasers to make sure that they have financing or cash in place. I'm doing a deal and the paperwork's all done and we have an accepted offer and I have 21 contingencies. Do we send it all to the lawyers right now, the purchasers and the seller's lawyers, to get them working on these files and intimately involved in this conversation to remove these 21 conditions?
I am curious if we are on the same page or not on this. So I'm going to say it depends on the closing. If it is a tight closing, I would advise that we send the offer off to the buyer's lawyer, not necessarily the seller's lawyer at this point, but the buyer's lawyer, so that at the very least they can slate in a time slot to do title search once all conditions have been removed versus receiving the offer, title search is due less than a week, they're already booked up with title search appointments or properties, and now they're trying to fit this in. But if they had received it earlier, they could have scheduled it and it wouldn't have been such a stress. So that's my viewpoint.
Would you say it's typical for the files not to be sent off to the lawyer's office until the deal has firmed up and the conditions are removed?
That is standard practice.
So when all the conditions are removed, which would typically be insurance, home inspection, financing, then and only then the files are sent off to the purchasers and the vendor's lawyers. You may at any time share this information with your lawyer. we don't share it with them because you may end up with a legal bill for a deal that's not going together because the contingencies haven't been, or the conditions haven't been fulfilled. Some lawyers' offices, in fact, most of them are very, very good, and they won't charge you unless it closes. But I do know lawyers' offices, they'll charge you $500 just to open up a file, and then the clock is ticking for all the advice they're giving you through this transaction that's not closing. But typically, the files get sent to the lawyers when the conditions are removed, because it becomes very annoying in certain instances, law office that keeps phoning and contacting you looking for stuff, and the deal's not even done.
That has happened, but the other has also happened that you had said to, with regards to the property doesn't end up coming together, the buyer's not able to satisfy their conditions, and the law firm ended up issuing a bill to the purchaser, which the purchaser was so upset that, and it, I was instructed, because this happened to me, I was instructed many years ago to forward this purchase and sale agreement off, which is why I do not do it anymore. I send it to my clients and say, you can forward this off to your lawyer. Because I sent it, they ended up calling my office and were not pleased, and they felt that I should have paid the legal fees, that I had no right, and there was nowhere was it documented that I had instructions to do so, so they were denying it. I actually did have it documented. They texted me this, and I was able to provide that to my broker at the time and said, look, they asked me to send this. I did not take the liberty. So you have to be careful as a buyer's agent to not get too excited and send it off to everyone. Everything has to be documented. You follow the instructions of your clients, but don't allow it to be done verbally, because people seem to have selective amnesia when it comes to this stuff. And I don't remember telling you to do that. I'm not paying this bill.
That's why our two rules in real estate should be disclose, 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 and document, document, document.
Yes, everything has to be in writing.
Anything you know that's going to affect the transaction legitimately should be disclosed. And anything that's said should be documented, even in the form of an amendment or an email. I'm not crazy about texts. Open houses. You wanted to cover the protocols at open houses. And before we do, I just wanted to ask you a candid question. And that is, how many kilometers away from an open house and how many signs do you install 2 weeks before every open house you have in the city?
The 2 weeks before. So my office's practice is, if we have an open house on a Saturday or Sunday, the marketing and advertising for that open house goes out Wednesday or Thursday before, latest Wednesday or Thursday, but typically Wednesday, say. Open house signs also go out around Wednesday or Thursday of that same week, so that we're not confusing the public with open house signs out 2 weeks before and people end up showing up.
I was coming home from Moncton once, and there's an agent in Charlottetown that had arrows leading from Moncton to the open house.
No, we don't. No, I wouldn't agree with that.
That within was just a joke.
Okay.
Because you see open houses in the city and they'll have 19 open house signs. They're using it as a form of advertising.
Oh, for sure.
And then you follow them and eventually you figure out you're just going in a circle. Tell us about the protocol, which was really the point of this message. You just messed up the joke totally.
Sorry.
Too serious.
So open houses, it is a privilege to go to an open house. It is not the consumer's right. A seller has agreed to open their house to the public to see if a buyer who may not be yet working with an agent, or who may be working with an agent but the agent isn't available, and this open house just appeared on realtor.ca and they'd really like to get in and see it. It gives them an opportunity to view it. Now, when you go through or go into an open house, most realtors, I'm not going to say all of them, but most realtors will have a protocol. They want a sign-in sheet. Things became very strict, and it's not that we didn't do it before COVID, but after COVID, it just implemented and the process became more, here's our protocol going forward. We want to know who's in the house, so we have a sign-in sheet. We're not going to hound you. You could end up just saying, I do not want to be contacted. And that's what they think, you know, the reason is. In some cases, it might be. However, I know for our office, we ask open house goers, would you like to be contacted? Should an offer come in or updated on this property? And if they say no, we just want to come in and take a look, that's fine. If they say yes, we'd like updates, that's great. We will do that. But it is the consumer, the public, lets us know. So we take your name and information down just for the safety and security for the buyer. We've had things stolen inside our open houses. We've had medicine cabinets raided. We've had jewelry. So we do try our best to advise sellers, make sure these things are tucked away, put away. We are one realtor. We're usually sitting in the main area, greeting people as they come in, and then they freely tour the home, which is why you really should have the names down of the people that are going through the home, touring it, so that if anything does happen, we know the names and contact information for them.
Would you think an open house is just a pacifier for the vendor, which is typically trying to sell a house that's overpriced?
So that's a whole other, yes, I agree along with you. Sometimes if a listing agent, especially a newer agent, if they don't have a real aggressive marketing plan in place. Now, I know you, Michael, have had your YouTube marketing channel, I believe, since 2006. You know, you are probably known as one of or the best marketing, real estate marketing expert on PEI from everything that I've heard and what I've seen. And I know you. So those agents who maybe fall short or are being compared to, say, an agent of your stature in your position may say, well, I'll do an open house. So it's just a marketing gimmick to pacify the seller to say, well, I'll offer it to the public. But that's only generating locals. To have an aggressive marketing plan, virtual tours, all of that online, in case our buyer is not on Prince Edward Island, they get an opportunity to tour the home. Plus, you increase the amount of exposure and traffic.
And that's sort of where I was going with the beginning of this until you messed it up. That it becomes almost a marketing plan to stick 25 open house signs with your name on them all over town, pointing to houses that are miles away. I really would question the effectiveness of an open house. I feel it's probably more used as a pacifier, and you do get vendors asking for it. It makes them feel all warm and fuzzy that people are going through the house. But at the end of the day, on a percentile basis, I don't think they're the ultimate weapon or even close to a major tool to sell houses in most markets.
Yeah, a couple times a year. Now, I obviously don't get to speak with every single realtor on the island, but a couple times a year, I do hear that a buyer walked in, they put in an offer, and they bought the property. But that is not the norm, and that is such a small percentage that actually ends up happening.
Rental properties. What are the pros and cons of having tenants in your rental property? And just to limit the discussion a bit, let's just discuss like triplexes, duplexes, and quads. We're not getting into 200-unit buildings here.
If we're looking at even duplexes, triplexes, or even just a single residential home, Michael, that has been rented out, you know, to have tenants inside that home does pose a challenge and an obstacle. I have had many over the years where I've had tenants that did not want to move, especially if it was a single family, so not just duplexes and triplexes and quads. They didn't want to move. They realize should the seller find, or the property owner, find a buyer for the property, they stand a high probability of being asked to leave. So they sabotage the selling of the property by not accommodating showing times, by having the home presented in a dirty fashion.
Grandma's died 3 times this month.
Oh.
Shift work.
A really good one is they stay during the showing and they tell the potential buyer
the deficiencies.
All the deficiencies and how horrible the house has been to live in. And how horrible the seller is. And, oh, I've seen that where I've had to just kind of like shuttle my clients through going, okay, thank you for the information. That's really good to know. And then we had to put it through the filter and determine how much is this tenant trying to sabotage and how much actually has some value to the information.
I had one waterfront home a few years back where I listed it, and I always ask the tenants, do you have somewhere to go in the event that this property sells immediately? Because I am concerned. I don't want to make them homeless. And in this particular case, oh, yes, they had somewhere to go. They're moving in with family. It's not a big deal. They just drive over there, move their furniture, and everything's good. Come time for closing, they fought us with Island Regulatory Appeals Commission, said they had nowhere to go. And IRAC had a hearing, and my purchasers ended up hiring a lawyer. Ultimately, the end of the day, we won. But this could potentially be an issue as well if they pull the IRAC card, which most tenants don't. Have you found that?
Most do not. And there are a lot of wonderful tenants out there. If they have a lease, obviously, they are allowed to stay for the duration of their lease. These are more so talking when a seller puts their home on the market and the tenants are now month to month, and there is the possibility or the option that whoever purchases the property is going to own or occupy the property. In that situation, yes, this is the scenarios that we're talking about. Now, if a buyer were to purchase the property and say they're going to own or occupy it, and then they end up evicting the tenants, you know, there's a whole other bunch of stuff that we can get into with regards to contracts and how to do that. However, if that seller or that new owner of the property, ends up doing some renovations and wanting to rent it out, as per the IRAC rules, you were to offer it to that previous tenant. So it gets kind of complicated. You might want to do your research, call IRAC with regards to tenants, the rules.
Or your lawyer.
Or your lawyer.
Preferably your lawyer.
IRAC is great. They're full
but
of...
But they don't represent you.
No, but they'll provide the information. So if you're a buyer looking to purchase something with tenants, do your homework. Realtors are not going to be having their heads filled with all this information. It's not something that we typically end up doing a ton of training in, unless it's a realtor that's into property management and they know the rules inside and out. That's not what the point of our conversation here is, but it can get very challenging trying to sell a property that has tenants. You need, on both sides of the transaction, the sellers need to do their homework and due diligence and know the situation and what are they financially responsible to do in order to ask the tenants, because there is a fee that the sellers would have to provide to a tenant in order for them to have to be evicted as a result of the sale of their property, and as well as the buyer needs to be aware. And are you taking the possession of the property with the tenant still in, because now you just bought the tenants? If you're hoping they're leaving a month or so later, like Michael said, it could be a little more difficult to get them out if you do it after it's closed too.
And if you're thinking about kicking all the tenants out, fixing the place up, and then increasing the rent 100%, I would advise you to get a legal opinion or more than one legal opinion on that, because honesty is the best policy. The island is a small place, and there's been numerous occasions where they've tried that. Or what they've done is they've told the vendors that they're moving into the building. They kick the tenants out only to find out that they're advertising for new tenants, but at different higher rental amounts, which may or may not, probably not allowed to do unless an application was put into IRAC. Not to beat this subject to death, Patty.
No, I think we covered the main point of what we wanted to cover on that.
Awesome. Well, thank you for everyone for listening. And I think that is it for this episode coming to you from Montague.
Yes, we're in Montague, which is on the eastern side of Prince Edward Island. And it is a cloudy, overcast day, but still very green. The trees are starting to change here in October. But it is lovely weather that we've been having here.
Have a great day, everyone.
Have a great day.